Comes Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. The Florida legislative session begins tomorrow. Teachers and their allies are holding a massive demonstration today in Tallahassee. In a minute or two, we'll talk with the president of the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association about education issues. We'll also hear later in the show from a human rights activist who is witnessing the situation for migrants and refugees on the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll also take your calls this hour. Here's the number, 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Before we begin, we have quick comments left by our listeners about last show. Last Monday, we heard from Trump administration officials and from some Democratic candidates for president about the U.S. airstrike that killed an Iranian general. Here's what two listeners had to say.
Although there are lots of things to comment to on the show, I called in to point out that it's nauseating to listen to Pompeo spew that rhetoric that he comes up with when you realize that, in reality, the United States of America and Israel are the two top terrorist nations in the world. They rain terror upon people all the time, and the fact that they would ever accuse anyone else of duplicating what they do and you know, say, hey, we can do it, but you can't, well, that's just absurd. I enjoyed your program. You did a great job, as you usually do.
My contempt. You played a clip of Joe Biden speaking on the recent killing of the Iranian general. Joe Biden has no credibility on this or any other foreign policy issue because he supported the disastrous war in Iraq. Joe Biden should tuck his head into the sand and go hide under a cactus somewhere. Joe Biden has no credibility on foreign policy whatsoever because of his support of all the disastrous wars. He never met a war he didn't like.
Well, those were listeners commenting about last week's show, which is on our website, WMNF.org/news. Later on in the broadcast, I'll give out the number for you to leave a voicemail about today's show. You can always listen to previous shows and comment on the stories on our website or join us on Twitter or Facebook at WMNF News. We're also on Instagram at WMNF News. Well, you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa. The Florida legislative session begins tomorrow. Teachers and their allies are holding a massive demonstration this afternoon in Tallahassee. Right now, we're going to go up to that demonstration, and we're joined live on the phone. Do I have Rob Crete on the phone?
You do. How's it going, Sean?
It's going great. Thanks so much for joining us. Rob is president of the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association. And I hear a lot of background noise, but you can hear me okay?
I can. We have a sea of people and buses here. I mean, the buses are countless with teachers, educators, educational support professionals, community members. I mean, there's so many people here. It's amazing.
So do you have an idea of how many people you're expecting? Because your rally, it's called the Take on Tallahassee, a Rally for Public Education. It's expected to start at 1:30. Do you know how many people will be there?
We're expecting about 10,000 people from across the state. And I would tell you right now, it's looking very promising.
You came up, I assume, on the bus from Hillsborough. How many people and how many teachers from Hillsborough came up on the buses?
We had just a little over 100 teachers, but we had four full buses of people that include some of our ESPs and many community members that want to come out and support our cause.
ESP, educational support.
Our educational support professionals.
So why are you there? Why are you rallying in Tallahassee today?
Quite honestly, Sean, it's the fact that we live in a state where we are a top five state in revenue, but we're a bottom five state in actually funding our public schools. And quite honestly, we're tired of it. For the past 20 years, funding has been dwindling for our public schools, and we want to stop that right now. And we believe that, you know, rallying here and talking about funding our future is the most important thing that we could do today.
So there's some controversy we read about over the weekend where the Department of Education sent an email to the Polk County school board and said that it's possible that those teachers who are joining the demonstration up there today are involved in a strike which will be illegal. What are your thoughts about that idea?
Well, we've been working on this rally for months and months, and we've been communicating with our school districts, our superintendents, and their staff. So we actually believe all of that stuff is hogwash. Luckily, in Hillsboro, we've had a very good working relationship with our school board and with our superintendent staff. So we've always been in open communication about what we were doing, and we don't expect to have that kind of pushback in Hillsboro.
We're speaking with Rob Crete. He's president of the Hillsboro Classroom Teachers Association. He's part of a large teachers rally in Tallahassee this afternoon. It's called Take on Tallahassee, a rally for public education. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. This is WMNF's Midpoint Monday. It's 12:11 in the afternoon. And the reason you hear a lot of background noise is because Rob is at a demonstration that he said he's expecting about 10,000 people at this demonstration in Tallahassee, which would certainly put it as one of the largest demonstrations in the state. If you'd like to join the conversation and ask a question, give us a call at 813-239-9663. Are you a teacher or do you have kids in school and you'd like to talk about education issues? We'd like to hear from you. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So Governor Ron DeSantis has called 2020 the year of the teacher. He wants to raise the minimum salary to $47,500 plus rework a bonus program. So Rob, as president of the Hillsboro Classroom Teachers Association, some of that must sound really good to you.
Well, yes, and honestly, the governor talking about teacher salaries and talking about funding education is promising. However, there are a lot of other teachers other than first-year teachers. There are veteran teachers who dedicated their lives to kids in their communities that also would need some sort of salary increase. But that's not really why we're here today. We're not here about our salaries. We're here about funding public education as a whole, including building more schools, getting technology, and lowering our class sizes for our teachers. It's really about the funding of our public schools. And really, that includes our base student allocation, which is the money that flows to locals. Too often, Tallahassee wants to dictate how school districts have to spend the money. They put money into categorical funds. So we're here to say, hey, the money needs to be going to the base student allocation so that locals can decide how that money could best be spent to help students and communities and schools.
Since you brought up class sizes, why don't you remind people, not everyone who's listening was a Floridian when this class size amendment was passed. Remind people the history of the class size amendment and compare that to how big classes are today.
Well, we did pass a class size amendment, and over the years, lawmakers have allowed it to kind of chip away. So whereas it used to be a hard cap number of students in schools, being 18 in elementary, 22 in middle, and 25 in high school, now the state allows an average of those classes. So that can leave you with some classes with upwards of 30, 35 kids. And that's not really what the taxpayers wanted. That's not what the voters wanted. And that's certainly not what we want for our schools and for our students.
And reducing class sizes and also, paying for some of the other things that you're suggesting, like adequately funding public education, that's going to cost money. Now, the plan that Governor DeSantis has is $900 million, $600 million for salaries and $300 million for bonuses. If you add that to the other things that you're asking for, that's a lot of money. Where will the state get that kind of money?
Well, I mean, as a guy that doesn't have the budget in front of him, I know there's a lot of different ways that we can find to get that money.
Hold on.
I know that if I were to buy a boat, I'm going to pay a lot of I'm going to pay taxes on that boat. If I was a billionaire and buying a yacht, for some reason, I wouldn't have to pay those taxes on a yacht. So, I mean, there's many different ways that we could find the money. And once again, we live in a state where it's the top five in revenue, but bottom five in funding our schools, quite unacceptable for many of us. We're going in. Let's go.
You're still available to talk, though, right?
I'm sorry?
You're still available to talk?
I am.
Okay, so we're speaking with Rob Crete. He's president of the Hillsboro Classroom Teachers Association. He is part right now of the large teachers rally in Tallahassee that begins at 1:30 this afternoon, but they're still organizing people. They bust in, Rob said, 100 teachers and four buses of people from Hillsboro County. And you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. And I want to ask you, Rob, about Governor DeSantis's plan for bonuses and how that changes what the current bonus situation is and what your take is on bonus pay in general.
Well, we're fundamentally against bonuses. It doesn't make teachers work harder. I mean, we're always doing what we can for our students each and every day. And bonuses are things that teachers can't rely on, not for their salary and not for planning and things that they need to do. So fundamentally, we're against these bonus schemes that the government and the legislature has been kind of shoving down our throats for the past 20 years. We believe that money needs to go to the base student allocation so we can actually negotiate higher salaries for all of our employees, including our educational support professionals, those that drive the buses and serve and create the lunches, and every single person that's out there working to help and educate these young people across our state.
The way that Florida teachers get their contracts is their individual county unions negotiate with the school boards in each individual county. So how would a plan like Governor DeSantis's, where he says something somewhat arbitrary, like here's what the minimum teacher salary is going to be, $47,500, how would that statewide directive affect each of the individual contract negotiations in each of the counties?
Sean, quite honestly, we don't know. This is unprecedented. Tallahassee has never really gotten into the weeds with how much teachers make, and now he's starting something where a base starting salary for teachers and not really having any money for others. So we don't really know what that would look like, other than it would have, in our district in Hillsborough, you would have teachers over their first 11, 12 years of their career making the same exact salary.
Oh, I want to focus in on Hillsborough County for a second since I've got you on the phone, and you're a president of the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association. One thing that we've been hearing in the last year or so in Hillsborough is that there was an idea floated about privatizing the custodial staff. Where does that idea stand right now?
As of right now, we're not exploring the privatizing of our custodial staff. We're centralizing our custodians. Whereas in the past, each school had their custodians and they would work within just their site. Now they'll have the essential spot that will make sure that there are custodians for a pod or a group of schools to make sure that those schools are serviced. And the district is going to look at this model for a while and believe that it can save some money as well.
Another Hillsborough-specific question that I wanted to ask you is, your superintendent is stepping down, he's retiring, and there's a search process right now going on for a new Hillsborough County superintendent. What can you tell us about the process? Is the process working out the way it should be going right now?
Quite honestly, Sean, that's a better question for our school board members, because they're the ones that get to decide on our new superintendent. And they're using something called a matrix, where they look through the resumes and the, through the small interviews they've had with the applicants so far, and then they'll narrow the search. So they've already done so once, and they will be doing so again in the coming week to get us down to about four or five different candidates. I'm now walking up, and there's a whole bunch of, I see hundreds of teachers with signs that are very unique. It's just amazing what I'm seeing right here now, Sean.
What do some of the signs say?
Across the state coming together.
Can you read us some of the signs?
Oh, yeah, sure. It says, this sign right here is half my funds for my classroom. Marching for all school employees, kids first, kids first, kids first. Polk County teachers are fired up. Let's see, where's the funding? I see a lot of signs for that. Funding our future. I'm hearing cheers. Kindergartners should be growing. My students are worth more. Fund our future. Using my outside voice for my students. It's amazing what's going on. Everybody's got homemade awesome signs. I got a great one here for Star Wars The Mandalorian. It says, fund our future. It is our way.
Well, I want to remind people that we're talking to Rob Creed. He's president of the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association. 100 teachers from Hillsborough County went up on 4 buses this morning to Tallahassee. Rob says there's going to be 10,000 people at this rally. It's called Take on Tallahassee, a rally for public education. That's why there's a lot of background noise. We're talking to Rob live by phone in Tallahassee. And so let me ask you about the lottery. There's been a lot of questions over the years. The lottery was supposed to pay for education, but some people see it as maybe a shell game or a bait and switch. How do you think that the lottery could be better used to fund education?
I'm losing you, Sean.
Okay, can you hear me right now, Rob?
I heard you there, yes.
Okay, I was just asking a question about how lottery funds are being used to fund education.
Basically, lottery funds, although the money does flow to education, but for every dollar that is put into the lottery fund to go to education, another dollar is brought out of the bottom to serve other purposes across the state. So, in essence, the lottery money has never really greatly affected public education. So if there's one thing that we could fix, we could easily just fix that bottom where it comes out like a sieve and make sure that every dollar that's supposed to go to education from the lottery fund is actually spent on education, because that's not the case today.
School grades are something that have been around since the 90s or so when Jeb Bush was the governor, and the teachers' unions generally oppose having a letter grade for a school. What are your thoughts about how that system could be improved?
Well, the system is broken, because what we find is that school grades tie directly to the socioeconomic neighborhoods of our community schools. So what we're doing is we're grading and saying, hey, that this school is poor, and we're not only not going to give it extra funds, but we're going to starve it of funds, because we do the ridiculous in our state. We take the schools that are earning an A and we give them extra money as opposed to the schools that truly need it. So we're actually starving schools that need those funds the most.
Our guest is Rob Crete. He's president of Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association, and he is in Tallahassee at the Take on Tallahassee, a rally for public education rally this hour. It begins at 1:30 officially, but people have been busing there since last night, from what I understand. He says that four buses took 100 teachers and others from Hillsborough to Tallahassee, and you can hear the cheers in the background. And if you have a question that you'd like to direct to Rob Crete, give us a call at 813-239-9663. It's 12:23 in the afternoon. You're listening to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. If you have any thoughts or any questions about education issues in Florida or in your community, give us a call. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. Rob, you would have a good handle, I think, about the number of teaching vacancies in the area and why there's so many vacancies. Across the state, I saw that there were 3,500 teaching vacancies at the beginning of the year. How do classrooms operate without teachers, and what can be done about filling those vacancies?
Well, first of all, the number one victim of those vacancies are our students in our communities. Teaching is a very difficult, multifaceted job, and it once you get into the classroom, there's many different challenges that we need to meet, to meet the needs of the students. So in itself, you're asking people to do a difficult job for a relatively low wage. So a couple of things that we could do to actually help young teachers and get more people into the field is, one, let's keep those class sizes down. Let's make sure that we have a competitive starting wage for our teachers, and make sure that they have the support when they're in those classrooms, so that way they can become better, stronger teachers. The first couple of years of teaching is very, very difficult, because you're kind of learning as you go. You're learning how to help and meet the needs of the kids, as well as, you know, trying to teach them at the same time. So it is a very challenging job.
In today's Tampa Bay Times, we heard from two state legislators, Representative Jennifer Webb, a Democrat from Gulfport, and Senator Gail Harrell, a Republican from Stewart. They're joining forces to try to limit how often the Baker Act is used to take school children to mental health facilities. So what can you tell us about the scale of the problem with the Baker Act in schools? And do you agree with Representative Webb that we're really saving Baker Acts for kids who really are an immediate threat for themselves or others would be the best idea?
Yeah, I would say, unfortunately, we've seen discipline problems be more and more pervasive in our schools over the past 20 years for many different reasons. And one thing that we definitely need to do is we need to fund mental health services better, so that way we can better meet those needs of those kids when they do have that when they have anger issues, or they're frustrated and they have no other outlet for those frustrations. So we're hoping that the funding that we're asking for today and funding our future, that some of those funds can be used for exactly that, the mental health services that our kids desperately need.
Our guest is Rob Crete, president of Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association. He's at the Take on Tallahassee, a rally for public education. And you have at least 15 or so scheduled speakers that are scheduled to speak this afternoon. And I'll run up a list of a couple, but if there's any other speakers that people should know about, for example, the Reverend Al Sharpton, who is the founder and president of National Action Network, is scheduled to be there. You have the president of the FEA, the Florida Education Association. You have students, teachers, professors, president of the United Faculty of Florida, president of the National Education Association. So you have Florida people, you have national people there. Who else am I leaving out?
Just many different community members. We're going to have the president of both of our national organizations, Randy Weingarten, from the president of the AFT, and Lily Garcia, who's the president of NEA, will also be here talking to all of those that are here for the rally. We're super excited. I mean, I can't believe the energy here because there's just so many groups. I'm trying to step away so it's not as loud, but there's chanting going on. There are signs everywhere, and people are just clapping it up as they're getting off of this sea of buses that I see here in the Leon County Civic Center parking lot. And that's where we're preparing to actually make a three-block walk to the old Capitol where the rally will actually take place.
Well, I want to thank our guest, Rob Crete, president of the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association, part of the giant teachers rally in Tallahassee that's starting this afternoon. It's called Take on Tallahassee, a rally for public education. Rob, anything before I let you go? Is there anything else that people should know, where they can find more information or anything that you'd like to tell them about education that we haven't covered yet?
I would just like them to ask their legislators and their lawmakers to fund our future appropriately, because I think we all agree that funding our public schools is great for all of our communities and all of our students and all of our schools. So we all believe in it, so let's make it happen here in Florida, because it can actually happen. We have the funds to truly fund our future appropriately. Well, Sean, I really appreciate being on your show today.
Thanks. Can I hold you for 1 second more? Because I got an email from Norma, and she is asking, would you ask how people who could not participate in the rally can support the organization and the effort? So if you could respond to Norma.
And I think I just answered that actually indirectly by saying, hey, just reach out to your lawmaker, email them, and tell them that, hey, funding our schools isn't a priority for you, because it's a priority for our communities across really the state, but certainly in Hillsborough County. We could do better with the funding that we're doing.
Well, Rob, thanks so much for being on WMNF's Midpoint today.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Sean.
All right, thank you very much. Well, I want to thank Rob Crete, president of the Hillsborough County Classroom Teachers Association. He's part of the large teachers rally in Tallahassee this afternoon. It's called Take on Tallahassee, a rally for public education. And stay tuned. We're going to go to a quick music break from the late Neil Peart and his bandmates. We'll bring in our next guest, and she's observing the human rights condition for migrants and refugees at the U.S.-Mexico border. So stay with us on 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. And if you'd like to call in a question, the number is 813-239-9663. Thanks so much for listening on 88.5 FM.
This is an editorial statement from the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation Board of Directors. The Equal Rights Amendment has been on the table for states' ratification since 1972. That is close to 50 years. The 3/4 ratification of the states, meaning 38 states, is required for passage. 37 have ratified the ERA, but Florida is not one of them. The amendment reads, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Passage would ensure that all people, regardless of gender, are assured of no discrimination in terms of property, employment, divorce, and other such matters." Let's be proactive. Start contacting your elected Florida representatives and senators to vote yes on the concurrent ERA resolutions to ensure equality for all Americans.
Well, welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. It's 12:31 in the afternoon, and you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. And if you'd like to call in, the number is 813-239-9663. Joining us now on the phone is Marina Welch, and I want to make sure, are you there, Marina?
I am, yes.
Great, thanks so much. Well, Marina is an activist who is observing the human rights condition for refugees and other migrants on the U.S. border in Brownsville, Texas, and nearby Matamoros, Mexico. So I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad you could join us. So, and I should point out, the reason that I'm talking to you is because you're from Tampa Bay, and you specifically went to the Texas border to find out more about the situation. So what group are you with there, and what are you doing there on the border?
So there's not a specific group that I joined other than the Witness Program, which was also the group that helped shut down Homestead and Tornillo children detention camps. And now they've moved the witnessing program to Brownsville to witness at the border to help facilitate changing the law about MPP, which is Remain in Mexico, and get us back to allowing asylum seekers to cross the border.
So for people who don't know what that means, remain in Mexico, give us an idea of what the policy normally would be like. What's the asylum process like for a person normally, and then how did the Trump administration change it pretty recently?
So the normal process would be someone would apply for asylum, and they would be allowed to come and state their case. Now they can come and apply and state their case, but then they are automatically returned to Mexico to await a hearing. Many of the hearings are taking months, if not years, and many are not heard at all. If they do not have an attorney to help represent them, they're typically not even heard. So, and now it appears that they may be returning people from the Mexican border, sending them to Guatemala instead of allowing them to wait at the border.
And we'll talk more about Guatemala in just a little bit, but I want to make sure this is clear to people. We're talking here about people who are refugees, and what that usually means is that they're in so much danger in their home country that they have to leave their homes, and they are coming to seek asylum in the United States. And the new policy is that the United States says, You might be in danger, okay? That's, you know, you may or may not be, but you can't come into the country. And that's kind of unprecedented around the world, isn't it?
That's correct, yes. It's, it goes against the our policy that seeking asylum is legal, and the government is trying to make it an illegal process. And MPP, Remain in Mexico, is rooted in hatred and evil. It's and creating this humanitarian crisis at the border.
Well, when it comes to refugees being resettled in the country, so now we're no longer talking about the people who haven't even been allowed in the country yet. Now we're talking about refugees who are being resettled inside the United States. The Trump administration recently said that the states could decide whether or not that refugees could be resettled into their states. And on Friday, we had the Texas governor, the governor of the state where you are visiting right now, said that there will be no refugees allowed to resettle in the second largest state in the country, and, you know, certainly one of the largest border states and one of the largest states with immigrant populations. No more refugees settling this year in the state of Texas. What's the reaction in Texas to that?
Sean, I haven't discussed that with anyone here that's from Texas. Most of our people that are here are from other places, and I haven't seen the news about that. I do know that, you know, my feelings and people that I work with, it's a horrendous decision that is just unnecessary. We have room. We have jobs and they have families in general. Most of these people have family members that they can come and stay with. So I'm appalled that Texas has done this, but I haven't really had the chance to talk to people about it here.
Earlier, you mentioned that you have visited the Homestead Detention Facility that last year, especially people were very familiar with in Homestead, Florida, which is south of Miami, and the condition there and the children there. You visited it from the outside. There was a stair that you could stand on, but why don't you describe what you saw when you went to Homestead and why you were there?
By standing on the step ladders, looking over the fence, because they had blocked off the chain link fence so we couldn't see through, were children. They state they were 13 to 17 years old. We definitely saw children younger than that who were playing. They would come out to play soccer for about 15 to 30 minutes per day. That was their playtime. There were tents that they had set up and a dormitory-style living facility. The children were escorted in the front and behind by guards. They weren't armed guards, but they were guards that kept them in line. It was very much a prison camp environment. And they would wave to us. They would make heart shapes with their hands to show that they knew we were there, and we would do the same, and we would play music for them. But it was a heart-wrenching experience to see hundreds and hundreds of these children, boys and girls, locked up in a detention camp.
Our guest is Marina Welch. She's an activist who is observing the human rights condition for refugees and other migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in Brownsville, Texas, and in nearby Matamoros, Mexico. And you can join this conversation by calling in 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. It's 12:38 in the afternoon, and you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan, and I want to ask you, Marina, have you been on the Texas-Mexico border long enough to report on the conditions you've seen there?
We got here yesterday, Saturday. We spent the day on the Brownsville side, and there was a protest in front of the tent courts, which were not open, but we made the news and were demonstrating that these tent courts are just a sham where...
Can I interrupt you for a second and tell... Can you repeat that? Tent cords?
Tent courts, yes. So they're tents, big white tents set up along the border where the asylum seekers come to have their case heard. They're heard by a judge from a remote location. It's videoed. So we did a protest there and then witnessing along the sidewalks of right across from the border crossing. And then this morning, I was able to cross into Matamoros. I toured the camp facility there, the tents that the individual families have set up go right up to the building that the is the crossing from the Mexico to U.S. side. There are hundreds and hundreds of tents. To my understanding, there are over 2,000 people there. They are getting medical care now. There are some porta potties set up and a small shower facility, although many people use the Rio Grande River to bathe in, which is incredibly filthy. I don't even know how to describe the despair, and yet the people are happy to see Americans come. The children are happy to see us. I would like to point out, too, one thing before I forget. We've seen stories and heard interviews with parents who are sending their young children across the bridge, because although the parents can't get asylum or come across, the U.S. will not refuse the children. So a child will be sent across the border, and the U.S. will take them into custody and send them to a facility. And that's how desperate these mothers and fathers are, knowing that they may have to go back to their country, but their child will likely be somewhat safe in the United States and not sent back. Their countries are so horrible and to live in.
Have you gotten an impression about which countries those are?
El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala.
What about from Mexico? Are there many of the people that you're running into, migrants from Mexico?
There are some. I did have a conversation with a young fellow today who spoke really good English. My Spanish is almost non-existent. He's from Mexico. He had been in the United States as a child, but went back to see family and then is not allowed to come back again. So he's waiting asylum and volunteering to help at different parts of the camp with people. He speaks English.
One interesting thing that you just mentioned a minute ago is when you said that the children were getting sent across by their families to increase their odds of getting across the border. They're doing this even though in the last 18 months or so, we've heard these horrific stories about how children, how the United States, especially specifically the Border Patrol, is taking in children and separating them from families and then losing track of those children. Yet these families are that desperate that they would send their children across the border and, you know, who knows if they'd ever be reconnected with them.
Exactly. And, you know, they're having, the mother or father is having to decide where they and their children will die. So do they take them back to their country of origin, or do they stay at the border? And, you know, there's issues at the border with cartels and crime and things, or do they run the risk of sending them to the United States knowing they may never see them again, but maybe they will have a life? It's just... Go ahead.
Oh, I interrupted you. I apologize. But I was going to ask you, you mentioned the cartels, you mentioned the crime, and we hear that at a lot of the border crossing was with Mexico. I admit my ignorance. I don't know that much about the Matamoros, Brownsville crossing. What is the situation, especially on the Mexico side, for cartels taking advantage of these migrants who are being at least temporarily denied entry into the U.S.?
What I was informed today, someone told me that Matamoros is slightly safer than most of the others because there's only one cartel, and they're, you know, working somewhat in cooperation with the Mexican government. So it's not as dangerous maybe as Juarez or some of the others. But again, if they leave the camp or at nighttime, things can get dangerous. There are kidnappings, and you know, and that's, I think, my understanding, the biggest issue is there's a kidnapping for ransom, so they have to, you know, kind of remain all together, family units, and not leave the camp itself.
Our guest is Marina Welch. She's an activist from Tampa Bay who is observing the human rights condition for refugees and other migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in Brownsville, Texas, and in nearby Matamoros, Mexico. And earlier you mentioned these things that I'm not familiar with, so I want to ask you a little bit more detail about them. These courts that are inside of tents along the border, I think on the U.S. side, what happens in those courts underneath these tents? So I assume that they're open air besides being in a tent, and they are people processed and then sent right back to the Mexico side of the border?
Yes, that's exactly right. I don't know what you mean by open air. They're an enclosed tent. They're large. They're just over the U.S. side, but behind a fence with armed guards from U.S. immigration keeping people out. And so an asylum seeker will go in and plead their case, and then they are given further court dates, sometimes, as I said, months down the road, and they are sent back to Matamoros to wait.
And the conditions in the camps in Matamoros that you've described, and also in Homestead, that is all part of this network of border detention centers. And today, a trial for a years-old lawsuit challenging detention conditions in Border Patrol stations will begin. The Border Patrol has faced scrutiny over the past year for reportedly dangerous and unsanitary conditions in its facility. Hundreds of thousands of migrants have come to the southern border. I'm reading, by the way, from the AP. In Tucson, a judge is presiding over a trial for a lawsuit that was first filed in June of 2015 and that targets the agency's Tucson sector, which has 8 stations in Arizona. Attorneys say migrants are held in unsanitary and freezing conditions with no access to medical care. And again, that trial will start today. So that's specifically about conditions that are in Tucson, Arizona, that sector. But you've seen Homestead, you've seen Brownsville now. What can you just, say about the detention conditions that you've seen and how it would compare to what was described in that AP story?
Well, I haven't actually been inside any detention facility. We weren't allowed to go into Homestead. As far as Matamoros, it's a, I wouldn't call it a detention facility. It's not run by the U.S. It's just developed over time with these people waiting to be heard. Now, some people have been bathing in the Rio Grande, which is very dangerous. They have improved somewhat, so there are some showers set up. There are porta potties set up now. There is a fabulous medical clinic providing medical services for free to anyone who needs it. And so I think the United States groups, the churches and Team Brownsville and various groups that are coming to support the asylum seekers have put forth a tremendous effort to provide some health and safety to the asylum seekers there. I don't know that it's the same elsewhere.
What kinds of condition? What kinds of supplies and help have they provided?
They are putting up tent covers over. The people are living in tents, so they're putting up tent covers over top of them to help protect them from rain, and to get them somewhat off the ground a little bit. They're providing cots. Various groups have donated cots. They're donating money. Global Resource Management is providing the medical services, which was a wonderful facility I got to tour today. It has a pharmacy. It has a OBGYN clinic and a regular clinic. So I was really happy to see that. And then the porta-potties and the showers. They also, someone has provided charging stations so people can charge their phones to be able to stay in communication with family and lawyers and things.
Joining us on the phone is Marina Welch. She's an activist who's observing the human rights condition for refugees and other migrants on the Mexico-U.S. border. She's in Brownsville, Texas right now. She's also visited nearby Matamoros, Mexico. And if you'd like to ask her a question about what she's seen or about the migrant situation in general, give us a call, 813-239-9663. You can also drop us a text at 813-433-0885 or email dj@wmnf.org. And earlier, Marina, you were talking about how the U.S. wants to send third country asylum seekers to Honduras. So even people who are seeking asylum in the United States but are not from Honduras, the U.S. wants to ship them to Honduras to stay until their case has been settled. And let me read a couple of sentences from the AP. U.S. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has said the U.S. and Honduras have finalized the implementation steps under an agreement that would allow the U.S. to send third country asylum seekers to Honduras. Speaking in Tegucigalpa on Thursday, Wolf commended Honduras for undertaking a humanitarian responsibility in agreeing to receive asylum seekers. A similar program has been working in Guatemala since November, and Wolf said it will begin in Honduras in the coming weeks. In exchange, the U.S. government has pledged to aid in the region's economic development. So the U.S. is giving, I'm translating now from government speak to real English. The U.S. is giving giving cash to these Central American countries if they will agree to take in people who are not from those countries that are trying to seek asylum in the United States. And the U.S. Acting Homeland Security Secretary calls it a humanitarian responsibility. Your thoughts on this type of program?
Well, my first thought is, when has the U.S. giving money to a country ever helped in a crisis of this type? Honestly, I didn't know that Honduras had become one of the countries, too. I did know that they started it for Guatemala. I don't think that asylum seekers who are waiting for court hearings and dates being sent to Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, are able to get back and forth to attend their court hearings at the border. So it doesn't seem like a good solution whatsoever to me. I think the solution that I would like to see is appoint more judges, appoint more, provide more assistance to the asylum seekers to have their cases be heard. They're leaving Honduras and Guatemala because of the dangers there. So why would we want to send them back? That doesn't seem humanitarian to me at all.
Yeah, to send someone from Guatemala or Honduras back to that country would be unspeakable if it's an asylum seeker. But maybe there's a difference. Let me play devil's advocate here. Maybe if it's someone from Cuba who is sent from the United States-Mexico border to Guatemala or Honduras, it's possible maybe they would not face the same dangers in Guatemala and Honduras as a native person of that country would. Is there any reason to believe that these people would be in less danger?
Not in my mind. They're dangerous countries, and why would they be any less so for someone from Cuba? I just don't see that as being a good plan.
Our guest is Marina Welch. She's a Tampa Bay activist. She's observing the human rights condition for refugees and other migrants on the Mexico-U.S. border. She's in Brownsville, Texas, and visiting also nearby Matamoros, Mexico. And you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to Midpoint Monday. It's 12:53 in the afternoon. And you can call in the show if you'd like, 813-239-9663. I'm going to ask you a question that's about migration in general, maybe not so much about refugees and crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, but I want to get your take on this. I'm reading another AP story. The Trump administration is considering dramatically expanding its much-litigated travel ban to additional countries. This comes amid a renewed election year focused by Trump on immigration issues. That's according to people familiar with deliberations. Two of the people said in a document circulated in the White House outlines the plans, but the countries that would be affected were blacked out. The expanded ban could include several countries that were initially included in the ban but later removed from the list. And, of course, the travel ban became infamous right at the beginning of the Trump administration because people perceived it as a Muslim ban and a ban on people from predominantly Muslim countries. So this isn't directly necessarily related, but I think people can see the connection between the migration situation and this travel ban. Do you have anything that you'd like to add to what I just read there?
Well, what I would like to say is that it originally was perceived as a Muslim ban. It was those countries that were part of the travel ban. And that did not go through because of activism and people standing up and saying, this is unacceptable. And I say that because the reason we're here witnessing at the border is because witnessing has brought this to the news. People are aware when we show up, when Americans show up and say, we're not going to tolerate this, that's how we get things changed. And so, you know, that's why my husband and I are here. and so many others from all over the country, and there's one lady from the UK as well, that are standing up and saying, this is unacceptable. And so we are going to stay here until this goes away, until this law is changed. And I had a lady ask me today, or say to me, how do you have hope? And I said, hope is what I have. I've seen it happen in Homestead, that we changed it, and it shut down, and the children mostly went to family and supporters. And so this will take longer, and will be more difficult, certainly. But I have hope that Americans don't want this kind of behavior going on in our country, this kind of crisis and evil in our country.
Our guest is Marina Welch, and she's on the U.S.-Mexico border. And Marina, we're going to go to the phones. So let's get this call here from Richard. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Well, first off, irony, we've got, if I understand correctly, a president whose grandfather was deported, then came back into the country illegally, taking these actions. But I do have some friends who spend a lot of time working and traveling to Honduras. I've never questioned it, like, do they live in a secure community or what they do, so on. But, well, actually, what they do, they're involved in mining. But I know the kidnapping and the violence and everything has been very well documented in Central America, but are Americans kind of not being targeted because they're worried about retribution from the United States? Would be the question for your guest.
Do you know the answer, Marina?
I'm sorry, Sean and Richard. I do not know the answer to that, but I would assume that, you know, because of money and what it would create, they're not being targeted by the cartels. But again, we are told when we go over to Matamoros not to go alone, to only go in daylight, to be very careful. I mean, we could be. We could easily become a target here in Mexico, so I would imagine that happens in those countries as well. It's possible. But I'm sorry I don't have a more comprehensive answer to that.
Well, no, but thank you for providing the information that you have, because more and more people need to be aware as to what's going on and why there's just no common sense rationale for denying these people status. I've had the privilege of meeting refugees, including several from Nazi Germany and several who survived concentration camps. They came to this country for freedom, not to be detained and deported back to the violence they came from.
Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you, Richard. Hello?
Yes, you're still on the air. Sorry about that.
I did want to say that, you know, in the late 1930s, early 1940s, the U.S. didn't want to get involved with the Nazi Germany issue and the refugees that were seeking asylum here. And after we did and learned all that we did, we said never again. And so that has become a battle cry. Never again is now. And we need to continue to stand up and say, this will not happen again.
Well, Marina, if people want to get involved and find out more and maybe even become a witness that goes to the border, and how would they go about getting involved and who would they contact?
There is a witness Facebook page, witness:Tornillo. Let me give you my email. I am happy for anyone who would like to get involved to email me and I'll put you in touch. It's MARINARWELCH, Marina R. Welch, @gmail.com. And I'm happy to connect you with Team Brownsville or the Witness Program or any of the volunteer organizations that are down here.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint Monday today, Marina.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for keeping this in the news. It's so important.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have had you on. Thanks so much. Marina Welch is an activist who is observing the human rights condition for refugees and other migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in Brownsville, Texas, and in nearby Matamoros, Mexico. I want to thank people who called and texted in today. If you'd like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts, call me at 813-238-8001, extension 114. I'll play your message next show. Thanks so much to Frank Knox for his help with the phones. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero Mark Bureau will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned right now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi.